I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Warner Brothers has been detailing more on Hogwarts Legacy, the open world RPG that's set in the 1800s, long before the birth of Harry Potter and even Newt Scamander. Apocalypse's Rick Henderson joins me to tell us all the details. Meanwhile, I've been catching up with the Chief Operating Officer at Verify My Age to find out how the company is trying to make the internet a safer place. Apocalypse Luke Baker has been filming with the Insta360 ONE RS action camera to see if it has what it takes to take on GoPro. Stay tuned to find out. But first, back to you, Rick. Tell us more about the Wizarding World's announcement.
Yeah, indeed. Harry Potter's, well, it's not Harry Potter game. Harry Potter's nowhere near it. But Hogwarts Legacy is incredibly exciting. We've waited for quite some time. It was announced a good year or so ago. We've now just had over 14 minutes of gameplay and details drop during the latest PlayStation State of Play address. And no matter how old you are and no matter how much you like or ambivalent about Harry Potter, this is looking like a great game. It basically is an open world RPG, as you said at the start. But it's way bigger than we could have imagined. You are a new student who goes to Hogwarts in the 1800s, and you get to choose exactly what type of student you want to be. You get to be sorted into the house, so you might not even be a Gryffindor, for example. You might be a Hufflepuff.
Outrage.
My daughter loves Hufflepuff, so she is desperate to be a Hufflepuff. So you get to do that. Yeah, there's companions you can pick up along the way. But the most interesting part is the depth of the gameplay that they showed. They showed an awful lot of stuff. Not only can you, for example, go to classes and learn potions, there's a new threat to the Wizarding World in the form of a goblin rebellion and a what we think is the ancestor of a Death Eater who team up to do bad stuff, basically.
And so if you've not, I mean, obviously people are aware of Harry Potter, right? And they're obviously aware of the Fantastic Beasts and stuff like that. And so it taps into all that lore. But from a gameplay perspective, are we kind of talking more Elder Scrolls or are we thinking more GTA 5 but with spells?
Well, it's a third-person game. I would say it reminded me quite a bit of something like Dragon Age or Horizon Zero Dawn / Forbidden West. Right. In the fact, it looks like a massive action adventure, but the beauty of it is that they haven't just restricted it to Hogwarts. You also get to go to Hogsmeade, the local town. There's the woods. There's all of the areas around Hogwarts as well, all of which are under threat by this new group of enemies. And you as a student, first you learn all the spells and you get to level up and create new spells and add them to the spell list you've got, but you also get to even learn like dark magic and right. stuff like that. So they've expanded it to be able to essentially do what everybody's always wanted to do within a Harry Potter universe game, which is essentially build their own student and go absolutely wild with it.
And do you think is this a trend that we're seeing? Because, you know, we've seen Elden Rings, which is a massive game that has, you know, it's coming out, it's been incredibly popular. Obviously, GTA series has been incredibly popular. These kind of open world games, they're not new, but do you think Hogwarts Legacy will have what it takes to kind of sit amongst the best of them? But also, do you think this starts a trend where we'll see this more from other types of franchises going forward?
Without a shadow of a doubt, I think the words action, adventure and role-playing game now lend themselves exactly to open world. There's actually a bit of a backlash on Twitter about open world games generally, not about Hogwarts Legacy. I've never seen such excitement about a single game that is yet to come out. as Hogwarts Legacy. But the there's a bit of a backlash on open world games because we've got there are a hell of a lot of them now.
Mm.
And they can take. I mean, for example, I had to review Horizon Forbidden West and Dying Light 2 back to back. Both are open world games. Both took me at least 80 hours to complete.
Which is a long time.
Which is a long time, but at the same time, great value for money. If they're good games, there's great value for money. But a lot of people backlash saying sometimes you just want to sit down, you want to play a nice, neat, story-based game that doesn't take too long. Now, the one thing I will say about Hogwarts Legacy and it being that kind of massive open-world game, certainly it's so it looks, is that if you've got a child of a certain age who absolutely adores Harry Potter, it might be a little bit out of their reach because there's you have to divert, you know, you're going to have to invest an awful lot of time, energy and play into this game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't feel like an Animal Crossing.
No. In fact, I would say they were aiming at like the sort of like teens to higher than that when they were looking at who to aim this game at. And obviously Harry Potter's audience is spans from like 5-year-olds all the way up. So, so this is definitely at the sort of like the upper reaches. But then people who watched the films or read the books originally, they're all in their 20s now anyway. So it's possibly not a bad idea.
Okay. And finally, is this likely to come out anytime soon?
We don't know the exact date, but we do know it's coming out holiday 2022. It was originally delayed. It was meant to come out last year, but they wanted to put more time and effort into the game. But now we're getting it prior to Christmas this year. I guess September, October.
Still to come, Luke gives us his verdict on the Insta 360 One RS action camera.
They need their own SD cards and everything, and it's a bit of a faff. Whereas this, you just bring a little cube-shaped module, and when you decide it's time to shoot in 360, you click it on and off you go, and it's really convenient.
The UK government recently announced its plans to include age verification for all pornographic websites as part of the Online Safety Bill, after pressure from charities and other stakeholders. But how does the technology work, and is it a good idea? Wanting to find out more, I recently caught up with Andy Ludlam, Chief Operating Officer at a company called Verify My Age. It's a British startup who helps companies verify people's age online, whether they're buying things or accessing information. I started by asking him to explain how the technology from the company actually works.
It's possibly not as simple as you think. It's quite sophisticated technology. So we partner with online businesses, and I'll start by giving you a couple of different examples. So we partner with eBay, for example, an e-commerce platform, who are conducting a transaction with someone buying an item on their website. Now, through eBay's API, we get passed the customer's information. So for example, their first name, surname, their address, mm-hmm. their mobile phone number, and we can do what we describe as stealth checks on their age. So that is using that PII. So we'll check their name and address, for example, do a soft credit lookup on a credit bureau. We can do a mobile phone number check, either to see whether their adult content block has been lifted, or we can do a check directly with their MNO to check whether that individual has gone through a KYC identity check as part of getting a credit approved for a contract phone.
Right.
So
basically,
if they're
old enough to buy stuff.
Exactly. If you are old enough to get credit, you are 18 and you've gone through an identity check to prove that. So we will then do possession on that mobile phone. We'll send a one-off SMS, and assuming that the user can prove that they are in possession of that phone by clicking on it, then we will approve that they are over the age of 18. So that's our stealth mode, and we can only run stealth age verification checks where obviously there is very little, if any, interaction required by the end user, and therefore the lowest possible friction for the online business. However, in the situation where, for example, with that e-commerce platform, we are unable to successfully complete a check, or if we are working with a business such as a pornography website, where that website does not have any PII on their user and is simply implementing an age gate at the front of their site to allow access, then we showcase our non-stealth methods where the user has to actively engage with them. So, for example, they can enter their credit card details and we can do a check on that credit card. They can also manually enter their phone number to go through the same process that I mentioned previously. They can use they can take a selfie and we can run an age estimation check on their facial.
And how does that, I mean, that sounds so. I just take a picture and it goes, oh, you're looking a bit old. Is that, I mean, how does that, how, what do you look for in those kind of things? And, you know, how does that work?
So we actually are an ecosystem. So we partner, we're not a deep tech business ourselves. We partner with third-party suppliers, providing us with best-in-class technical solutions. And we, some of those businesses do 2D checks, as you said, with taking a picture, but the more reliable and more accurate tech is actually a video selfie. So it assesses your biometric features. So
we'll find my crow's feet, so to speak. And I'm too old.
Fortunately, we're not doing this on camera, but with follically challenged myself, I think I passed with flying colors. But actually, these are very, very sophisticated pieces of technology, AI technology, that have learned through hundreds of thousands of different images, ground truth images. They can learn when they've made the correct decision and what facial biometric features contribute towards that. So, for example, one of the suppliers we actually now work with multiple AI suppliers on facial recognition and use an ensemble model to improve the accuracy of our results. So each of those providers gives us either an age, so 15, for example, or an age range, so 18 to 24. And our algorithm, our ensemble model, spits out an age that is more accurate than any of those individual supplier contributions.
Right, because pull from the collective rather than just relying on one specific company.
So we aggregate and we give a, for example, if it's an 18 age-restricted product, we just simply give a binary answer to that website whether that individual is over the age of 18 or not. But with facial age estimation, for example, if you go into a supermarket and buy a bottle of wine, you'll see challenge 25 script on a poster next to the till. And what that means is that the shop staff are required to ask you for identification if they believe that you look under the age of 25. So, for example, with our product and when we integrate for the online sale of alcohol, we set the age threshold at 25 to mirror the requirement in the real world.
It sounds like there's a lot of things you were talking through there. There's obviously a lot of data points here. And with a world that we live in where people are slightly concerned and worried about the data that people store on them what's available and if that gets leaked, and especially when we're talking about pornography sites where you might not necessarily want your name on a database somewhere, how do you go about challenging and combating that fear?
It's a good question, and it's one that comes up quite frequently. Our technology at Verify My Age is entirely privacy preserving, and I would say that we are not the only age verification solution that would claim that. All personal information is encrypted and hashed both at transit and at rest. When we pass information onto a third-party business, so an adult website, a pornography website, or an e-commerce business, we only ever give them a binary answer. So a 1 or a 0, a yes, no. Is this person over the age of 18, 21, 16, whatever the requirement is? It's also worth saying that we are big advocates that age verification providers such as our supplier, such as ourselves, should be independently certified and go through an audit process, for which there is one here in the UK, there is one in Germany, there's not currently in France, for example, to make sure that our technology is fully GDPR compliant and that we are in fact operating in the manner that I said, in that we do not store anyone's personal information, and we do not send any personal information to a third party website that we work with. We very much advocate for a world where, you know, the opposite of a Wild West. We want to be fully certified and fully audited, and we sort of lobby for that in the territories that we work in.
And do you find, I mean, obviously I know there's a lot of conversation in the media at the moment, certainly within the UK, about, you know, this pornography bill, for the lack of a better word, where it's kind of insisting that all adult sites have age verification on them. Is that really the only, I know you mentioned eBay at the beginning, but is that really the only sort of real need for this? Or are there sort of times where you need age verification, which the listeners might think, oh, I hadn't thought about that?
Well, there's age verification is a sort of use case for identity authentication. And it's where a lower level of assurance is required. So if you open a bank account, you go through full KYC, full anti-money laundering checks. That has the highest level of assurance, and the methods that are approved for those use cases are typically more stringent than age verification, which is where you still need to prove that someone is of a certain age, but you don't necessarily have to do three different identity checks with full name, address, and identity right. documents. Yes, you can, if that's the preferred method for an end user. However, we are, you know, the online world has been very slow to catch up with the sort of the real world or the offline world. If you think of how difficult it was for when people like myself were growing up to access, you know, pornographic content, it was really quite difficult. Now it's incredibly easy. You can go onto a pornographic website and there is either no age verification requirement or a simple click a box to confirm that you're over 18, and that is clearly not fit for purpose. However, you're right, sort of I would say the traditional age-restricted categories are the ones that would immediately spring to people's mind, alcohol being an obvious one, e-cigarettes or e-liquids being another, pornography being another one. But actually, we're right on the cusp of what we call internally the sort of regulatory wave, where you'll be able to do very few things online without going through some sort of age or identity check. And that's not to say for a minute that any of that information would be shared with a social media platform or an image or PII itself. But there has to be some sort of audit trail or some sort of accountability for a business to know who their users are. So another piece of legislation came in September last year, which is regulated by the ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office, which is called the Children's Code. And that requires all businesses where there is a risk of content or they are highly likely to have children on their platform to know the age or the age range of their users. So they've called out sectors such as social media, online video gaming, ed tech. So it's not just about 18 plus, which are the obvious use cases. But for example, if you are playing a video game, there are certain games that are clearly appropriate for a 7 or an 8 year old. And there are some that are clearly not appropriate for a 7 or 8 year old and are only appropriate for someone of 16 plus or 18 plus. And that legislation is also related to GDPR and the way that a business uses an individual's data if they are over or under the age of consent, which is 13 here in the UK. So we also have, we call this age assurance rather than age verification, that we can bracket people in different age groups under 18, as well as give a binary answer on whether people are over the age of 18.
So I know as a company that obviously deals in age verification, the idea of the adult industry having to use age verification is probably good news for you guys, certainly from the bottom line perspective. But do you agree with what the UK government are trying to do?
I personally absolutely do, and I think it's long overdue. And as I mentioned earlier, it's been far too easy for far too long for children to easily access pornographic material online, not just on pornography websites, but also on social media platforms. And they are also caught up in this new piece of legislation. I think, you know, parents just need to know that, you know, in order for children to benefit from all the opportunity and all the positives that the internet provides, they need that sort of reassurance that they're not going to be exposed to harmful content whilst they're doing that. And so I'm a big believer in this piece of legislation. It's age verification, as I mentioned earlier. It's not KYC, so there is a lower level of assurance required. And I think that it's, you know, I've got a young daughter myself, and I wouldn't want her to grow up in a world where accessing such harmful content is so readily, so easily done, as they're, you know, conducting online experiences.
And I suppose the final question I have for you is you're obviously, as a company, you're obviously starting to look at AI and how that can be used to help do your job. Where do you see it all going in the future? So if we were to have this conversation in 5 years' time, what do you see the landscape and the technology to look like there?
Good question. I think it's increasingly will move to an AI world. I think it's slow to move. You know, identity document checks or credit card checks are all fairly well established. Facial age estimation is the only AI method currently that there's been enough testing, enough data to validate and substantiate that it is as accurate as businesses such as myself will be able to will claim that it is. However, we also have other methods that are in sort of R&D around biometrics. So, for example, that's voice. We're working with a third-party supplier on, you know, being able to tell to a certain level of accuracy through simply listening to someone's voice. There's also another metric around hand span, so the distance between the end of your thumb and the end of your little finger, which is I was not aware of, but it's very predictable in terms of the speed that grows from a young age up through to a more mature sort of adult.
You know, I'm looking at my hand right now. Thinking,
yeah, and I was doing the same. And again, a second reason why it's good that we're not on camera for this conversation. They are the two that are sort of I'm aware and sort of firmly in R&D and being progressed quite quickly. In terms of actually, if you sort of move away from age verification to actual sort of being able to authenticate or unlock a biometric password, then there's also technology around heartbeat, so using something similar to what you'd have in a smartwatch, for example, and also going under a sort of fingerprint to a sort of, and I'm not an expert on this, so apologies if this is not quite the right way of explaining this, but a sort of vein network,
right,
just under your finger, which is apparently far more unique to an individual than the actual fingerprint, and obviously less people would sort of believe that people are more readily likely to want to share that piece of biometric information than a fingerprint because of its association with sort of criminal and illegal activity.
When the Insta360 ONE R launched back in 2020, it was a camera unlike any we'd seen before. The clever modular design meant that it could be used as a 360-degree camera or as an action camera by simply clicking on a different lens module. Now, a couple of years later, the Insta360 is looking to refine its formula with the introduction of the ONE RS. But with GoPro still dominating the market, can Insta360 make an impact? Pocalint's Luke Baker has been using the new camera and joins us to tell us more. So, Luke, what's it like?
So I've been playing with the ONE RS for a couple of weeks now. And it's very good. It's kind of, it can't quite match GoPro's flagship offerings when it comes to pure image quality.
Right.
But the versatility and the value for money is like, yeah, on it in its own world. So essentially, for about the price of a GoPro Hero 10, slightly more than a Hero 10, you get essentially a GoPro Max thrown into the deal. So you'd have to effectively spend double to get the same versatility from GoPro.
That's quite a difference.
Yeah, and there's also the convenience of not having to carry two separate cameras. You can just carry the camera and a little module, and then swap them as and when you need.
So for people that aren't fully aware of, let's wind it back slightly. So for people that aren't fully aware of the Insta ONE, this is a camera. It came with a lens, a body, and a battery pack. Is that right?
Yeah, so the whole system is, it's kind of like little Lego bricks for camera geeks is a good way to put it.
That's a great way to put it.
It's so you've got a battery module, you've got a brain of the camera, and you've got two lens modules in the twin edition box. And you can either use the camera as a traditional action camera like a GoPro, or you can use it as a 360 camera by clicking on the 360 module. So it's like a two-in-one transformer situation.
And that then obviously just that plugs in and off you go, shooting 4K, I presume, all the...
Yeah, so the main module, they're calling it the 4K boost module now. And the old module was 4K as well, but they've increased the sensor size and added a few new features to improve the image quality. And then the 360 module does 5.7K 360 videos, but that module is actually completely unchanged from the original camera. But the really cool thing they've done is they've made everything backwards compatible. So if you have the original camera and maybe you're interested in the new 4K boost lens, or maybe you're just interested in the upgraded battery pack, which is a bit bigger, then you can just buy whichever piece you want and click them together and off you go.
Now, you alluded to this slightly at the beginning that maybe the quality isn't as good as a top-of-the-range GoPro.
Yeah.
Is that the only thing that you didn't like, or were there other things that were slightly concerning you?
No, there's nothing concerning. Like, it's all very good. It's just that they can't quite match the best of the best. But like I said, the value's there, so it's still an attractive proposition. The one big downside, I suppose, is that the screen is very small, because right. The screen has to fit onto this little cube-shaped module. And it's cool that you can flip the screen around. So if you want the screen on the front, then you unclick it and flip it around. Whereas on the flagship GoPros, there's a large screen on the back and a smaller screen on the front. So it's the same functionality, but you're stuck with a very small screen because of the modular design. And there's not really anything they can do about that other than, I guess, making a bigger module that clicks on or something.
And for someone that's maybe have had a GoPro in the past, it's, you know, is getting old, maybe it's broken and need to think about upgrading, what's the bit that you like the most about this from having been a GoPro user yourself for a while?
The main thing is just having everything in a small package. I had the original GoPro Fusion 360 camera, and that was quite big and heavy. And if I wanted to shoot 360 video and regular action video in one trip, then I'd have to bring both cameras mm-hmm. with me, and they'd need their own SD cards and everything. And it's a bit of a faff. Whereas this, you just bring a little cube-shaped module, and when you decide it's time to shoot in 360, you click it on and off you go. And it's really convenient.
And the usual question, if they ask for this back, are you going to be sad, or are you going to be, oh, well, never mind?
Yeah, I would be, actually, because, it's a convenience thing, mainly. It's great that you can stick something so small in your bag and have so many options. I could see it getting used a lot until the dreaded day that they say can have it back.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Until next time, thanks for listening. Pip, pip.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.